Blog Talk Radio.
How's it going, everybody? Chris Block here, the third man in radio here on Blog Talk Radio. This is Tuesday night, September the 6th, 2011, 8 o'clock here in Chicago. And I am Chris Block, writer, editor, and keeper of thethirdmanin.com. And let's get right into it. Tonight, we're welcoming back to the show, just one, John of fifthfeather.com. How are you doing tonight, John?
Good, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing rather well. As good as can be considered. Wanted to get you on the show because for a lot of reasons, the Internet Underground has been a buzz. The Fifth Feather has been away all summer, taking a break at cottage, so to speak. Why don't you give everybody up to speed on what's going on over at fifthfeather.com and maybe what they can expect in the coming weeks as the season get going?
Sure. This summer we kind of, without really announcing it, we just kind of took a hiatus. Things, it just felt like for a while, like, I don't know, this year, I don't know if it was the same with you, but it felt like this season really took a lot out of the both of us, more so than any of the other seasons combined. And kind of at the end of the year, we wanted to talk about where the site was going, what we were going to do. So obviously for like the big events, like the draft and free agency, we were obviously going to, update for that. But after that, I think we both kind of decided, let's kind of take a break, clear our heads, and see where it's going. And then, hopefully for this season, we're trying to decide what we're going to do as far as, but it's definitely going to be something different. I don't think you're going to see the daily game recaps, and if they are, they're going to be much shorter than what they were. Just kind of give a place for some people to talk about the game, blow some steam off or whatever. But as far as the content of the website, I think we're going to try and do something different because, as you know, it seems like all the sites, everybody's just saying the same thing in a different way, and we're trying to, do something different. So hopefully we can come up with something that'll be pretty good.
And for everybody listening, probably, about the time that the Blackhawks report to camp, or is there a date yet that you guys figure you'll be getting back in some sort of regular schedule?
Probably preseason, I would think. After the first couple games, that'll probably get us out of our cave and back to the grind, so to speak.
Yeah, there really hasn't been a lot going on. We want to tonight on the show. Basically, what I want to do is kind of put a lid on the summer. I'm tired of the summer. Miraculously, Labor Day weekend, the long weekend, it seemed like the season actually did change over the weekend. Friday was hot, steamy, sweaty, and then yesterday, Monday, being Labor Day, it was 65, a little rainy, cold, brisk. It seems like fall, and it seems like hockey's around the corner. So I want to put a lid on the summer. Let's put it away. I'm tired of talking about it, and John's here to help us do that. But first, I want to make a couple of mentions before we get going, and I'll forget to do this. Next Monday, September 12th, Mike Peck, play-by-play voice of the Rockford IceHogs, is going to be on the show. We're going to be talking about that coaching change out there in Rockford that's very important. Bill Peters, of course, gone on to the Detroit Red Wings on the bench with Mike Babcock. So Ted Dent steps up. He's going to be in that position. We're going to talk to Mike. Mike's got a unique perspective, I think, working so closely with those two. So he's going to give us the lowdown on Ted Dent, what he thinks we should expect from Dent, and then also everything else that goes on or we can expect from Peck's perspective in the upcoming 2011-12 season. Also in the future, Sam Fells, Committed Indian, SecondCityHockey.com. And at some point, the return of the superstar. We're going to hear about what that guy's been up to and some surprises along the way. Tomorrow night, September 7th at 11 p.m. Eastern, 10 Central, and 8 Pacific, I will be on the L.A. Kings podcast, Let's Go Kings, on the Blog Talk Radio Network. That's blogtalkradio.com/Let's Go Kings. So you can check that out tomorrow night, September 7th. Before we get going on the Blackhawks stuff, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about this. It's the hot-button issue right now, and it's so important to the future, to the health of these of NHL, and all hockey players everywhere, really. Of course, the deaths, the tragic deaths, the three that are getting the pub, but also going back to January, minor leaguer and a former Harvard grad, Tom Cavanaugh. He appeared to lose his mind and take his own life in a parking garage. And then, of course, the summer started off with Derek Boogaard, a mix of painkillers and alcohol, which is a death cocktail, no matter how you slice it. And he passed away. Then Rick Rippon takes his own life, reportedly. And Wade Belak would be the third of the summer. Initial reports saying that Wade Belak took his own life. And then over the weekend, I don't know, a lot of people being away, if you missed it, now there's some suggestion by people close to Belak, and there's reports out there that it may not have been an intentional suicide, that he definitely hung himself. He definitely died that way, but it may not have been a suicide. And I'll leave that to, because, I mean, that's a report going on. It's in the Globe and Mail. It was on Yahoo Puck Daddy, the hockey tabloid over the weekend. And so it's out there. It's there for everybody's consumption. A guy hanging himself but not suicide, it doesn't really leave much room for the imagination. Michael Hutchence, the lead singer of NXS, had a similar incident years and years ago. So, but we'll leave it at that. But John, I don't really want to talk about the backlash or get a response. I mean, of course, it's tragic and all of that. But from our perspective, if you are Gary Bettman, and that's the thing going on right now, what's to be done? And there's the small-mindedness, in my opinion, of we got to get rid of fighting. Let me ask you, John. If you're Gary Bettman, how do you respond to three players, four going back to Cavanaugh, all losing their life? If you're Gary Bettman, you're in his spot. How do you take ownership of this situation? How do you respond?
Well, I think it's kind of already taken place. I mean, if you notice, the game has become more about skill. So I think in that regard, a lot of these guys, if you take the three of them, all of them, what they have in common, they're all, quote-unquote enforcers or fighters. But the thing is that, I think as far as, like, what he could do, I don't know if there's really anything, because I would venture to guess that the majority of the fights that caused the most damage to these three guys all took place at the lower levels, whether it be juniors or the AHL or the UHL or wherever the hell they played. That's where they were probably, dropping the gloves every game. So, when you see that, there's nothing he can do about that. There's nothing that Gary Bettman would be able to respond, oh, yeah, well, we should get rid of fighting in the AHL. Well, nobody's going to listen to him because he has no jurisdiction there. So I think in that regard, there's nothing he can do. As far as his response, I think, the game has changed to more of a skill game to where, you have the hard cap, you have a limited amount of roster space, you only have 23 skaters that you can, or 21 skaters that you can keep on your team. So there's only, a limited amount of guys that you can have, and you're not going to waste a roster spot on somebody that, will play 82 games, score 3 points and have 250 penalty minutes. I mean, that's just not the way the game is played anymore. So I think if it continues to evolve the game, I think you'll see these guys being phased out, and that's really the only way that he can address it without really addressing it, in my opinion.
And I mean, that's really the game too. He wants to address it without really addressing it. I mean, it's, you know, as far as taking fighting out of the game, I think that there's going to be a day. There'll come a day when they can eliminate, they can take fighting out of the game, and there won't be an effect on the business end. There won't be much of a backlash. But, I mean, let's look at everything that's going on around, you know, the NHL. What's the fastest growing sport, both in terms of revenue, in terms of television viewership, in terms of that coveted 18 to 40 category, you know, on TV? It's mixed martial arts. It's the UFC. What is that about? It's all about fighting. And that's on television every week, it seems like. So, I mean, the UFC just signed a $100 million per year television rights deal with Fox. $100 million less than the NHL, but they're also going to be producing less hours of television. So people want to see fights. I don't know where this, you know, we need to take fighting out of hockey is coming from, because I think there's still a risk of taking some of that allure out of the game. Now, I'll say this. You're right. I think that the days of the guy who sits on the end of the bench or sits on the roster only to play against, you know, I mean, Blackhawks fans would call it the St. Louis Blues of the league. And you know, I think that the days of that are nearing the end. We're almost at that point where you're right, where you just cannot have that guy on the team. And I think through, you know, however you want to call it, just the advancements of the game, that's happening. We're almost at that point. If it continues on the way it has. I think, though, that one of the things that's being overlooked here, I didn't have a chance to pull the audio, but Wade Bielak, 5 days before he died, was on the radio, and maybe it's, you know, it's a radio appearance, so he's not going to go on and not get up for it, but he didn't sound like a guy who was depressed. He didn't sound like a guy who had emotional problems. But he also said that he didn't have problems with concussions in his, you know, because he was there to talk about, you know, ironically, the Rippon and Bugard death. He said that he didn't have problems with concussions during his career. But, you know, one of the byproducts of concussions that come from that, especially if you get players who then get, you know, because one of the things when you get a concussion, one of the things you get prescribed are, you know, some guys will, not all will take them, but, you know, attention deficit disorder pills, you know, and if you get hooked on those and you overuse them, that can lead down a road of depression as well. So I think the thing that I would do immediately, and I talked about this a little bit with Al Simaglia last week, the first thing I do if I'm Gary Bettman, I sit down with the Players Association and I take head injuries and the management of those and the overseeing of those inside of a hockey game and out, you know, even outside as well, I take that governing away from the individual teams. It's like in boxing, okay? The corner, you know, your corners, you have a doctor, a cut man in your corner. Your corner man doesn't come in and decide whether or not the fight is going to continue. I mean, in it, you know, ultimately, it's the ringside doctor is appointed by the commission. He's there, he comes in, and he determines whether or not you can continue. He doesn't have an emotional investment. He's not paid by the team. And I'm not saying, and we talked about this last week, I'm not saying that there's impropriety going on, but the fact of the matter is, any team, you have a doctor that's paid by the team, he's around the team, he has a relationship with all these players. I think that you have to take that responsibility away from that. It's, the head injuries are serious business, and it's getting worse and worse and worse. And I think from an NHL's perspective, I think you need to appoint a doctor in each city where that doctor or a member of his staff is going to be at that game. And let's take Brent Seabrook in the playoffs against Vancouver, game three, for example. If Brent Seabrook gets an apparent head injury, that doctor, that independent doctor that's appointed by the NHL that answers only to the NHL, is there, and he's the one reviewing Brent Seabrook and deciding whether or not he can go back into the game. Because, you know, it's like in boxing, if a guy gets knocked out, or mixed martial arts, if a guy is knocked out, he's not in the gym 5 days later taking headshots. And that's the environment that, you have in the NHL right now, is because guys will they'll get knocked out. Look at Marty Hablett 3 years ago. He gets knocked out less than 48 hours later, he's on the ice playing hockey. That can't happen. So I think that that's where this thing needs to go, first and foremost. And secondly, it's absolutely imperative, because I think chemical dependency is a bigger issue in the game, in the NHL, and even in the minor league level than anybody knows. The league has to go in and they have to reevaluate their therapeutic use exemption, because the way that it's written, and it's been written since 2005, it essentially gives license to players to take whatever they want as long as they have a doctor's note. And that's wrong. And that's where you get the cycle of dependency. Because if you it's there for everybody to read. You can go and read it. If I'm an NHL player and I want to take steroids, and believe me, players do. If I want to take steroids, all I have to do is, if I decide I need to put on weight, and I want to go, and that's what I want to do. Everybody's saying that I'm too small and I need to bulk up. Well, what's the easiest way to do that over 4 months during the off season? Unfortunately, the easiest way to do it is to get on some performance-enhancing drugs. Well, the NHL doesn't test in the off season. They don't test in the preseason, and they don't test in the postseason, which is criminal. Okay, all I have to do is go get on some steroids. Okay, take them for a month, 2 months, and not heavy dosage steroids, because those will stay in my system for a very long time. But just get on some steroids, and then I'm going to get off of them 4 weeks before camp, and then as camp approaches, I'm going to go and I'm going to get tested, and as soon as those things are out of my system, I'm then going to go to a doctor and claim that I've got low energy, and I'm going to get my TE levels tested. Because the thing with steroids that people some people understand, is that what happens is when you take steroids, your endocrine system doesn't produce as much testosterone because it adjusts. It doesn't need to, because you're putting synthetic testosterone, steroids, into your body. So it adjusts. And then once you get off those steroids, it takes your endocrine system a while to get back to normal. So there's going to be a period where you have low levels of testosterone. That in a normal person, an average person, that process of losing that, that production of testosterone doesn't happen to your late 30s. Well, guess what? We have players running around in the NHL in their mid-20s and early 30s are running around with therapeutic testosterone use exemptions. And there's a lot wrong with that. And I think that you need to go in and reevaluate that. Anybody that's got a therapeutic use exemption, Sean Hill, the one guy in the NHL that got busted for steroids because he made the mistake of putting a horse steroid in his body, Sean Hill had a therapeutic use exemption that he got away with using for a while until he got busted on boldenone. Brian Berard got busted at the Olympics. Did he get suspended by the NHL? No, because they gave him a therapeutic use exemption. Same thing with Jose Theodore. Everybody laughed, Propecia this. He gets suspended for 2 years by the IOC, the NHL. Oh, that's okay. You got a doctor's note. Here's a therapeutic use exemption. I think they need to reevaluate that. Anybody who gets a therapeutic use exemption needs to be monitored. They need to be tested, and for whatever. And that's not just steroids. It's the stimulants that players get. It's the painkillers they get hooked on, and a lot of that begins in the playoffs when they know they're not going to get tested, and it's like, you hear it all the time. Hockey players will play through anything. And they'll come back. Well, how are they doing that? They're not superhuman. They're not that much tougher than football players or basketball players. Have you ever seen a basketball player or a 30-year-old basketball player try to walk after a game? I mean, they're not that much tougher than those other players. They're getting help. And a lot of that dependency starts in postseason, the off season, and it continues on in the NHL. They have the knowledge. They know who's doing what. And for the most part, because some guys aren't getting caught with what they're doing. But they know what everybody's doing. They have the information. And they have to go in and attack that therapeutic use exemption and fix that. So you don't have guys that are getting, it's like with Bugard. Bugard went through the substance abuse program. Did he ever get busted for a substance? No, because he had a therapeutic use. So, I mean, they have to – a lot of questions have to be answered about that program, and they have to adjust that, because that's where the problem is. It's not fighting. You know, it's unfortunate that you have that guy on the end of the bench that knows. I mean, maybe he's got a broken bone in his fist, but he knows that if he doesn't go out and fight, then he's out of a job. There, stuff like that does go on at all levels, not just the NHL. You know, the guys that are just hanging on. Instead of, you know, and that's the other problem. The NHL doesn't test their players that are in the minor league system. So, you know, of course guys that are making $2,500 a week in the AHL are going to do whatever they possibly can to get promoted in the NHL so they can make 25 grand a week. It's a big difference. They don't test any of those guys, and that's wrong as well. I think the NHL's got a lockdown on this thing. It is a joke. Their policy is a joke. Dick Pound was right, and they have to rectify that, and that's where it all starts, I think, with those two things. From my perspective, you have independent review of concussions. Put it in the hand. The league needs to take ownership of that because it's getting out of control. And the therapeutic use. Start there, and I think you're on your way to possibly, and it's what you can do. It's what the NHL can do, and they should do, and that's where I would start if I was Gary Bettman.
Yeah, I mean, those are obviously very good points. I always laugh whenever I hear people say, like always quickly dismiss that any hockey player could ever do steroids. And it's always – I always just greet that with a roll of the eyes. I mean, it's just – I mean, considering that a few years ago everybody was addicted to I can't think of the drug now, but it opens up your whole nasal cavity. I can't think of what it is. But there was like an SI article, and there was like 98% of hockey players were addicted to that. And they would all take a couple pills before the game. I mean, it's just – anybody's going to do whatever they can to get a competitive advantage. And, you know, I just think that you're right. They need to put some more teeth into the therapeutic distribution.
The one thing about the way the rule is written as well, and I want to get off of this and get into the Hawk stuff because we covered some of this last week, but the thing that disturbs me most about the way the therapeutic rule is written, and everybody can go to the CBA and read it, is that there is a period of review. Say I'm an NHL, I don't want to use anybody as an example, say I'm an NHL player, and I'm taking, we'll just use steroids, okay? Stimulants are a banned substance, and many stimulants, amphetamines are in the NHL. They use WADA's list, World Anti-Doping Agency, the out-of-competition list. They use that. Downers, as you would call them, antidepressant drugs, sleeping aids, those aren't banned substances, but stimulants are. Let's just say I go in and get busted for steroids. The way the policy is written, there is then a confidential period of review where I can go, as the person who tested positive for steroids, I can go and then present an argument as to why I need to take steroids. You know, in other words, go to a doctor and get him to give me a testosterone prescription for therapeutic use. And then I can go to the NHL, the board that oversees, you know, the drug testing, and apply for a therapeutic use. If I'm taking a drug that I don't have a therapeutic use for, why am I taking it, and how am I not getting suspended? That's what's – beyond everything else, that's what's most ludicrous about their policy and why nobody tests positive for anything. So – Let's move on with the Blackhawks stuff. So, John, we'll get to Dan Carcillo in a little bit. But
okay.
I don't think we're too far. We haven't talked about it, so we'll get to that later. But I guess to start off, what was the one thing over the summer, maybe Brian Campbell excluded because that's the obvious one. What's the one thing coming out of the summer that stands out most to you about the changes that were made on the Blackhawks?
Well, yeah, obviously, like you said, the Campbell thing is just, I don't think anybody, I remember, you know, talking about it with you a couple of times and with, you know, with Blackhawk fans in general, and there's just no way that anybody realistically thought that they could have unloaded the Campbell contract. So obviously when that happened, that was a big stunner. But as far as what else stands out, I mean, you're looking at just probably how much they've changed their blue line, I would say. To me, that's like their biggest difference. I think it's going to take a little while for fans to adjust to what they're seeing. I think they were so used to the last couple of years, last 3 years, of having a defense that was just, you know, you had two speed burners on the top four pairs, or the top four, and I don't think it's going to be like that, like the same. It's not going to look the same as it did the last 3 years. So I think, to me, that stands out the most when you're looking at them adding Monador, O'Donnell, and Sammy Lepisto. And then you're asking Nick Leddy to obviously play more minutes and probably play up to, you know, 20 to 25 minutes a night, unless, you know, Steve Monador and Sammy Lepisto are, you know, just setting the world on fire to start the season. But, yeah, I mean, to me, that's what stands out above the rest. The amount of confidence they're showing in Nick Leddy and, obviously, their new additions.
Yeah, obviously, there's a lot of pressure on Nick Leddy. He's going to be a part of this defense. He's being eyeballed for that number four position. I think when you look at everything as a whole, the way that Stan Bowman, everything that Stan Bowman did, he's trying to recapture that formula that won the Stanley Cup back in 2010. It's a little over a year ago. It seems like a long time ago. But, with the fourth line, whereas Carcillo is kind of like that Burrish guy on one side, Mayers is more responsible and more intelligent, but, kind of in that eager role on another side. It's just, the question is, who's going to be the center on that line? Is it going to be Kruger? Is it Ben Smith? Who's the center that plays the John Madden role on that line? But to me, yeah, the defense, it's a lot of pressure on Nick Leddy, because if Monador, as much as I like Monador, I keep saying this thing, they overpaid for Monador. There's no question about that. But it was a position of need. They had to go out and settle it in free agency, and that's what happens. It's the same thing that would happen with Brian Campbell. It's just a lot less money for a third pair guy as opposed to what Brian Campbell was coming in to do. So, but you still overpaid for him, but in a position of need. But you lose Campbell, and, wasn't a big fan of Campoli, but Campoli on your third pair is a nice guy to have. You lose those two, you add Monador, O'Donnell, and Lepisto, and, you got John Scott sort of dangling there at the moment as the eighth guy. Is the defense as a whole, like, let's just forecast, let's look at this thing in February after they have time to work this out. Is the defense as a whole any better? Or is it just there's more bodies that can actually play? What are your thoughts there?
Like I said, I think it's going to be different. It's going to look a lot different than it did the previous 3 years. Will it be better? It can't really be worse as opposed to what they were throwing out there last February. You said, Monador is a third pair. Sean O'Donnell, I don't know how much he has left in the tank. As a seventh guy, I don't think he'll kill you. I know last year, seeing him in limited amounts with Philadelphia, I thought in the first half of the season he was a completely different player. In the second half, it seemed like they really rode him ragged through that first half, and he just had nothing in the tank to end the season. And that's going to happen when you're, 4 years old. Sammy Lepisto, I think he's another guy that's, a fifth, sixth, seventh type defenseman. Whether he can play the puck possession, moving the puck out of danger on your own, that remains to be seen. I know he did a decent job in Phoenix, but, the expectations there are a lot lower, and, the system is probably a little different than the one that Joel Quenneville prefers. So it's going to sound like a cop-out, but I guess we're just going to have to wait and see whether they're any better. I think they're definitely deeper. I think they're definitely more experienced. I think they're definitely tougher. Whether or not they're any better, killing penalties, which was a huge weakness for them last year. Whether or not how they match up against, other teams' second, third, and fourth lines, I think that just remains to be seen.
The defense is a huge part of this, because if you look across the Central Division now, Nashville is going to be Nashville. They're just going to be pesky to play against. They're going to be in every game, and they're going to drive you nuts. But if you look at the rest of the division now, St. Louis included, and even Columbus, every team in the division now has two scoring lines. And you know, that's something that hasn't existed before in Columbus and St. Louis. Every team has two lines that can bite you. And the Blackhawks are already one of, you know, I think they were third in the league last year in goals scored. And goal differential, they were right up there as well. So as far as scoring goals, the Blackhawks can't do much better. I mean, you hope that you get more from Marian Hossa this year and a little bit more consistently. If you get Dave Bowen healthy all year long, which is a huge question mark, but if you do, you get 20 goals from him. You hope that Michael Frolik has a better year, you know, shooting at the net. And Brian Bickell can replicate what he did before. You're going to score a lot of goals, but the question is, can you prevent goals from being scored against you, especially in this division? And I think there's a lot of pressure on Leddy, because obviously if Leddy becomes, you know, I use Drew Doughty, and that's an unfair comparison because I think Doughty's a much better player in the long run than Leddy. But if Leddy can have that kind of sophomore season where he takes two steps from where he was as a rookie, I think you're going to be okay. But still, the most important guy on the defense as far as taking another step and being more of a veteran leader and a guy that can settle things down and make life easier for Nick Leddy is Nicklas Hjalmarsson. He's the most important guy. I think Keith is going to be better. I think Seabrook's going to be better. Monitor is a nice guy to have on that third pair. And then O'Donnell, like you said, if you monitor his minutes, and, you know, you pace him right, he can be effective. And Lepisto is, I don't know. I don't think that Lepisto is a bad player, but I just, you know, he's coming here to be a part-time player first and foremost. So he'll get what he earns. So it's kind of, you know, we'll wait and see. But it's that Leddy and Hjalmarsson pair, which is, it's going to be eventually, I think. You know, I know that a lot of people think, and you'll probably see Leddy and Keith back together again. I just don't like the Hjalmarsson Seabrook pair at all. It's, you know, on a penalty kill, fine, but 5-on-5, 4-on-4, I don't like that pair at all. But I don't know. I think that it's a lot of pressure on Leddy, and it's a must that Hjalmarsson has a coming of age season. And steps up. Otherwise, I do think that they have problems. O'Donnell, at this age, I don't know that he's any better than Jim Vandermeer. You know, and do you want Jim Vandermeer on your defense? No.
Oh, yeah, only as a seventh defenseman.
Yeah. So I think there's still question marks, and I, you know, we'll see. But that's everywhere on the team. That's my biggest question mark, and we'll see how it goes. Now, I think the other guy that the Hawks lost, and I don't know if this is being underestimated by fans, by management, but the guy, you know, and there are reasons why he's not around anymore, but Troy Brouwer. I guess first and foremost, going to the Capitals, do you see Troy Brouwer having an Andrew Ladd-type coming out party, going to a place? I think he's going to get good minutes. I think he's going to play on the top two lines there. What do you see Troy Brouwer doing as he goes on to a new organization?
I don't know about Ladd. I don't foresee 30 goals in his future. I mean, I think if he plays with, you know, if he's on a line with Backstrom and Ovechkin, then, you know, anything's possible. You know, he could probably score 30 goals just by, you know, being on the ice at the same time as those guys and just accidentally hitting the puck and it goes in the net. I don't know if he's good for 30 though. I think, you know, you'll probably get the same thing, 18 and 18. You know, a decent guy you can kind of bounce around the lineup. Whether or not Bruce Boudreau, I don't know what his plans are for him. I'm assuming that they're probably going to have him on one of their top three lines. I didn't think that they acquired him to be a fourth line plugger. I would expect him to kind of fill that Eric Fair role that they kind of lost when he signed with Winnipeg, you know, to be that kind of, you know, gritty guy who can kind of skate on any of their lines and, you know, give them the predictable slash line.
When the trade happened, that my first thought was playing on, you know, a line with Ovechkin or, you know, or Semin even. You know, those guys that just wing the puck from any, you know, it's going towards the net, but it doesn't always get there. And having watched Brouwer when, you know, he played in Norfolk and in Rockford, you know, that's his strength. His strength is being around the net and picking up rebounds. He's got great touch around the net. It's just the farther he gets away from it, the less effective he is. And I think he's matured a little bit physically and you know, on the wall and in that sense. So he can help in those categories, but where his real strength is around the net. And while the other guys are carrying the puck and doing the work as far as getting the puck into the zone, setting up a play, he can just go and concentrate on picking up the garbage around the net. I think he'll have a 20-goal season. I use Ladd as a guy who, for the comparison, he's just a guy who was a third-line guy in Chicago. Everybody knew he was an important player and he was a nice player to have, but did anybody, I know I didn't, I like Ladd a lot. I didn't expect him to go do what he did in Atlanta. So that's why I kind of use that comparison. I think if he does, if Brouwer ends up in the right situation, I think he's going to have a lot of success there. If he's bounced around like he is here or he was in Chicago, you're right. I think you're probably getting the same results, but they didn't acquire him to be a fourth-line guy, and that's not his strength. His strength's not a checking-line guy. He's not a fourth-line plugger. It's, you know, it's picking up garbage. It's the touch around the net, and they need that because of Ovechkin and Semin just firing pucks from all over the place. He's going to get a lot of scoring chances, and I think that's his strength, and I think he'll have some success there. But Brouwer being gone, Andrew Brunette comes in, and obviously that's one of Brunette's strengths, his touch around the net, being sneaky and picking up loose pucks and putting them away. But at 38 now, he just turned 38, he's on the downside of his career. I don't know that he can exist, especially at the tempo that the Blackhawks like to play with, and they're not going to change their style of play. So at the tempo that the Blackhawks like to set, I don't think he can exist on a top line all year long. I think he's going to move around a lot. And, you know, I think maybe he gets 20 goals if he's out there on the power play enough. But there's clearly a void on one of those top two lines on the left side. Is Brian Bickell that guy ultimately, or dare I suggest, is that the spot that perhaps they're hoping Victor Stahlberg fits into?
Well, actually, Stahlberg is an interesting one because if you look at their roster right now, it really seems like there's no spot for him. If you kind of just break it down, you know, by lines, when you look at the top line, you look at the second line, you look at the third line. The third line's obviously, if you're starting off the year, it'll be Bolin, Frolik, Bickell. Second line, some combination of, you know, Hossa, Brunette, Kane, Sharp, Taves, you know, all those. Stahlberg doesn't really fit in there, and he doesn't fit in the fourth line, which is, as we speak, it's Mayers, Carcillo, and I can't think of his name now. But, you know, Stahlberg, he's a man without a home. And, you know, it is kind of interesting what exactly do they have in store for him, because really we don't know. They obviously signed him to a two-year deal when they could have just let him walk. So they do like him, and they do want him around. So you have to wonder, is he going to get another look? Is he going to get an extended look with Kane and Taves? Is he going to be able to skate alongside Marian Hossa and be his left wing and kind of, you know, pick up the garbage points that Thomas Kopetsky picked up last year? I just don't know. You always forget about him when you're doing mock lines for the Hawks or whatever. Stahlberg's always that guy that gets kind of forgotten, and you know, like you said, he's going to have to play somewhere. So I'm kind of interested to see where he's going to fall into the mix.
I've always looked at it from a line balance standpoint. I've made the suggestion before that if Victor Stahlberg is on my fourth line, and I could have, if in a perfect world, if I could have a fourth line that had, you know, that big body on one side that was going to crash, you know, everything in his path along the walls. He's going to go to the front of the net. He's going to be a disturbance. Because my fourth line is my bump line. It's my energy line. So if I've got that, I've got a responsible, you know, centerman who's going to, you know, because one of the first, you know, fourth lines are always matched up against each other, and the first thing that you want is to win that draw, because you don't want to be chasing some other team's fourth line around. And if you are, your fourth line's not going to get minutes. And if I can have somebody on that other side that's got the kind of wheels that Stallberg has and a little bit of skill, which matched up against a lot of teams' other fourth lines, is superior skill in a fourth line versus fourth line sense. I like that. But it's obvious the way the Blackhawks have set this thing up this summer, Stan Bowman, that, you know, he could talk about, you know, we'll get into Carcillo in a second, but you could talk about, you know, Carcillo can play anywhere. But, you know, and the Flyers last year, they tried him everywhere and nothing worked. He was an RFA, and they did let him walk. So he's there for that fourth-line energy guy. They've said as much that that's what they want out of him. So that's going to be on the fourth line. You got Mayers, who's, if he's in the lineup, he's a fourth-line player. And then you've got whoever you've got in the middle, which is not a Stallberg position. So it's obvious to me that Stallberg is going to play on one of the top three lines. I don't know. He doesn't fit on the Bolin line. So it's basically a question of who wins the job. Is it Rusty Oles once he's healthy, if he's healthy in time for training camp, or is it Victor Stallberg? It's probably the competition heading into camp, at least in my view.
Yeah, it's kind of, for me, for my money, as far as the last roster spot, I've always said that it's going to be between Ben Smith and Marcus Kruger as far as being that, you know, 13th guy or whatever you want to say. I don't think, assuming that everybody's healthy, if Oles has recovered from his knee injury, you know, I don't think that they're going to send him down to Rockford or the KHL or whatever. I just have a hard time believing Stan Bowman's going to walk into Rocky Wirtz's office and ask him to pay, you know, this guy $3 million to go away. You know, as much as, you know, Rocky Wirtz likes to cover up mistakes, I just don't see him doing this immediately. Maybe after, you know, 40, 50 games and Oles is just, you know, he can't pick up their system. He's not, you know, he's not doing anything out there. Then maybe I can see them saying, you know what, we'll bite the bullet on this one. We'll send him down to Rockford for the year, let him clear waivers, and then he can go wherever he wants the next, you know, 2 years of his contract. But to me, it's going to come down to Ben Smith and Marcus Kruger if everybody's healthy. And then I just don't see Marcus Kruger not being on this team to start the season. So I think, for me, I think Ben Smith might be the odd man out if everybody's healthy.
Yeah, it's starting to, you're right. It's starting to look more and more like that, especially with, you know, if you look at, and I did a write-up on the site last night about the Rockford Ice Hogs and their depth chart and everything. And if you really look at things, I mean, you know, it's not like, I mean, Ben Smith came up and did really well for the Hawks down the stretch, but you know, he had that spot because there were injuries and there were guys out of the lineup and it wasn't a perfect, you know, I mean, there was a spot there for him, to whereas I don't know that there's one spot for Ben Smith on the roster right now. So, and it's not like his game can't use some more time in Rockford. So it is looking more like that. Marcus Kruger said it again. You know, he came over here in an interview, I think, with Adam Johns last week. He came over here to play for the Blackhawks. And, you know, he could go back to the Swedish Elite League and make a couple hundred grand. You know, he doesn't have to play here for $67,000 in the minors. So he came here to play for the Blackhawks. I think that they like him that much. You know, and Stan Bowman last year when they brought him over, they kept saying over and over, we think he can play on our team. We thought that he could play on the Blackhawks, you know, early on in the season. They just couldn't guarantee him a spot coming out of camp, so he went back to Sweden. I think that he's got a spot on this team. It's his spot to lose, let's say, and that would be the truth. I mean, it's his spot to lose, and I think, yeah, it's you know, it's got to be one of those things. If it's Ben Smith, if it's Jeremy Morin, you know, whomever, they almost have to play so well in training camp that you cannot deny them a spot. And I don't know that Ben Smith, as much as I like him, his versatility and his all-around game as a player and his attitude, I don't know that he has that in him to have that great of a camp. But we'll see. But, yeah, it's looking more and more like Ben Smith will be the odd guy out, just in a number sense. Speaking of odd guys out, though, John Scott, you know, you've alluded to it. You know, the way this is shaking out, it's looking more and more to me like he's going to be put through waivers and sent to Rockford if he passes. Do you expect that?
I've seen you written this the past couple blog posts, and it's kind of funny because I've been thinking the same thing, but at the same time, I can't imagine them doing it only for the fact that they can keep him on the roster and they can say, well, here's a guy that we have who can play offense or defense. If, you know, somebody comes down with the cold and we can't get somebody in, you know, we're in San Jose and somebody in Rockford's playing in Rochester, you know, here's an easy guy that we can just plug in for a game and then, you know, be done with it and not have to worry. Because, you know, during the season, you know, all sorts of crazy stuff happens, and sometimes you're only playing with 12 forwards. And, you know, I think John Scott's that type of guy where they can keep him on the NHL roster, and they can justify it by saying, you know, he can play at both positions, and he'll be an emergency filling guy, and, you know, it won't hurt anybody if he only plays 25 games this year. And I think that, I think that's what they're going to do, but, you know, I'll be happy if they decide to pass him through waivers, because at this point he is pretty much even more irrelevant on this team than he was last year.
He's even more irrelevant because you've got two guys, and Mayer's is getting to that age where he's not going to drop the gloves a lot, but it's not necessary to drop the gloves a lot. You know, you've got Mayer's there who will do it. When O'Donnell's in the lineup, and again, he's a guy that's up there, but he'll do it. You've got Carcillo, who's basically, you know, he'll do it. You know, so you've got different guys now, to whereas last year the Blackhawks, I mean, they barely had one guy that would drop the gloves and stick up for his teammates. So now you've got those guys who will play on the team and skate a regular shift, which John Scott's not capable of, at least where he left us last year he wasn't capable of. I know he's working really hard this summer and all of that, but you know what? That could also be the Blackhawks. We don't know what he was told. Stan Bowman could have went to John Scott and said, listen, unless you improve your skating, we don't have a spot for you, and if we try to pass you through waivers, unless you show that your skating's improved in training camp and exhibition, all these other scouts are going to look at you the same way, and you're going to end up in the AHL. So work on your skating, you know, try to come out and impress people, and if we don't have a spot for you, we pass you through waivers, you could still be in the NHL. Otherwise, you're going to end up in Rockford. I could see that conversation happening with him, and him working as hard as he can potentially to make a spot on the Hawks, but also just to keep his name out there and be picked up by some other team if he gets put there. That said, you've got seven, again, all if healthy. Anything can happen in training camp. Brian Campbell got hurt last September in training camp, and Jason Cullimore ended up on the Blackhawks for 36 games. Anything can happen. But if you're healthy, you've already got seven defensemen. You have one or two extra forwards. I just don't see where John Scott ever gets in a game, and why would you bother carrying him if that's the case? You know, that's, you know, I just keep coming back to that. And the thing that he does best, the other thing about his fighting, and it's you know, it's fun to watch John Scott drop the gloves with someone and pummel someone because of his reach, because of his height, his strength, and his boxing skill. It's fun to watch that. But you know what? Part of fighting is changing momentum and boosting morale. And the problem with John Scott when he fights, there's nothing to be gained from it on a Blackhawks perspective. If he wins the fight, he was expected to win the fight. If he, you know, if the other guy puts up a fight, it's a momentum boost because of John Scott's aura, because he's, you know, lost one or two fights in his whole pro career. It's a momentum boost for the other team, just like it was with Kevin Westgarth in L.A. It's a momentum boost for the other team. And if, you know, for some reason John Scott loses a fight, forget about it. There's nothing to be gained from John Scott fighting. And if that's the only thing he can do, I don't know why he's on the team.
Yeah, I agree, but 100%. And the only thing that I keep coming back to is, you know, how much the Blackhawks love versatility and the fact that they can talk themselves into him being able to play both positions and not having to play, you know, 50-some games to stay in shape. And that's the only reason I can see them keeping him on. But he's definitely, in a perfect world, he should be the, you know, the first guy passed through waivers and sent to Rockford to cut the roster down.
Yeah, well, we'll know in Well, we'll know definitely 30 days from now. One way or another, we're going to know 30 days from now. One guy that, you know, we'll get down to it with the guy that shocked me the most. And not just – I don't have a problem with Dan Carcillo being on the Blackhawks. I don't care who's on the Blackhawks. I really don't. But the problem that I have with the Dan Carcillo acquisition, hear me out, is that somewhat due to the immediate response of Blackhawks fans. I've listened to Blackhawks fans for 3 years ridicule and make fun of the Vancouver Canucks for when the going gets tough, losing their heads and, you know, costing themselves hockey games. And now I don't know, I can't tell the future, I don't know whether Dan Carcillo is going to do that on the Blackhawks or not, but he has a history of losing his head and doing dumb things. Is he taking penalties? And you know, John, you wrote a fantastic article this summer on and going back and looking at his penalty history and all that. But I come back to the very first thing that you have to deal with Dan Carcillo this year is what? He's suspended for the first two games of the season for what? Going into business for himself, getting in referees' faces, and getting himself a two-game suspension for abuse of officials during a playoff series. I don't know how you can justify that kind of behavior. I'm not talking about you, John. I don't know your whole opinion of it. But as you know, generally, how, you know, Stan Bowman could bring him in here and say, yeah, we like this guy, we like what he brings and all that. I have concerns about what he brings and the effect that it could have. And secondarily, you've got, when people have asked me about Kyle Beach and what kind of player he projects to be and what's he like and how is he progressing, in the past, and this was last year and the year before Dan Carcillo became a Blackhawk, I compared him to Dan Carcillo as a guy who has some skill. At this point, it doesn't project to be top-end skill, talking about Kyle Beach, but he's a guy who's easily distracted. You know, he loses his focus on the ice, and he, at times, gets himself into trouble. And, you know, Carcillo, he has a history, whether he's over it or not, he has a history of costing his team at times. And I've always compared. So that's the second part of that is what kind of message does that send to Kyle Beach? Now, Kyle Beach appears to be on his last legs with the organization anyway, but I would think that you wouldn't want to set that example for Beach. Those are just my two things. I think if it works out and he can keep his head, I think as an energy guy who's, you know, going to stir the pot and focus on his role on the fourth line, I think he's fine, and then I would address the topic of not playing him in the playoffs because he might be too big of a risk. But as the season wears along, I think he has a role. But that's just my thoughts on it, and I want to give John the floor and hear what you have to say about it.
Yeah, I was equally stunned when they signed him. I knew when he had gotten when he wasn't given an offer by the Flyers. I know Tim Sassone had written a little post that, you know, why wouldn't, can't remember if he tweeted it or wrote a blog post about, you know, why wouldn't the Hawks take a look at him, and, you know, everybody kind of poo-pooed it, and then sure enough, they signed him. The one thing I do like about it is, there's a couple things I like about it. One is that, I know you compared it to the Vancouver Canucks, and I think that's a little different because you got somebody behind the bench for the Hawks and Joel Quenneville who's not the idiot abettor that Alain Vigneault is. You look at a coach like Alain Vigneault, and it starts at the top, and there's a reason why all his players act the way they do. That's not to say that Joel Quenneville is a perfect coach, but I think he is a little bit better at keeping his players' emotions in check. You know, a few Ben Eager incidents notwithstanding, or the Game 4 incident against Detroit a few years back. The other thing I like about the Carcillo signing is that he wasn't given an offer by the Flyers. He knows that his NHL career is kind of hanging in the balance here. He was given a 1 year below what he should have made. If he was given a restricted offer, he would have made over $1 million. So he got, you know, his pay cut in half because he didn't get an offer from Philadelphia. and he was an unrestricted free agent. He got sent loose, and he only got a one-year offer. So I think, to me, I don't want to say low risk, because there is obviously more than low risk. I would say it's more of a medium risk, high reward type signing. The worst thing that could happen is if the Hawks are kind of a middling team like they were from a year ago, and then you got Carcillo acting like a goofball, you know, on a nightly basis, and it'll just look bad for everybody at that point. If things are going great, everybody's going to love him. They're going to think he's the reason why, you know, the Hawks are 20 points ahead of Detroit in the division, and they got the division wrapped up by February. You know, if that, it's just, you and I have both been following hockey enough to know, and know Blackhawk fans enough, that, you know, he's going to be the reason why, if they're good, they're good. But there is obviously, you know, a decent amount of risk that if things start going bad, he is going to be, you know, public enemy number one as far as why things are going bad, and he'll be the example for, you know, these are the type of players that the Hawks just don't need. As for the Kyle Beach thing, you know, obviously you can speak to that better than I can. I think Kyle Beach is kind of, like you said, on his last legs of this organization. I think it's a little, I don't want to say it's different, but I think the Hawks have seen, you know, Kyle Beach at every level, and they know what he's capable of. Whereas with Dan Carcillo, I think they could kind of, you know, turn the other way on certain issues and say, well, you know, that would never happen in our organization.
Or, you know, there's higher expectations of Beach, going along with, you know, the point you've made. There's higher expectations of Beach as a first line or a second line scoring winger, whereas Carcillo is being brought in to play a specific role. And, you know, there's no grand illusions that Carcillo is going to score 25 goals and, you know, be the perfect guy to play with Taze and Kane or Taze and Hossa. He's the fourth line guy, the energy guy, the guy to give you a little bit of a character and stir the pot, and that's what he's being brought in to do. You know, that's fair. I would go along with that. You brought something up there that, you know, you talk about the reason why the Blackhawks are going to be better. I think, and I, you know, going back to the Vancouver series, and I'll get your thoughts in a second. My impression when that series was over was that the Blackhawks had issues as far as, you know, the fourth line just didn't match up against the other team. And Vancouver, you know, specifically in games 1, 2, and 3, Vancouver just had so much more energy than the Blackhawks. And, you know, that came from their third and fourth line and how the Blackhawks got out-physicaled out of the building, you know, up to that point in the series. But outside of that and looking at the series as a whole, I thought that Vancouver's best players outperformed the Hawks' best players. And when I look at this season and, you know, kind of put a lid on all of these moves, I think that the moves themselves are largely irrelevant, you know, outside of, you know, if O'Donnell, if for some reason Monitor, you know, tanks it and is a bad player and Jalmerson stays where he is and Letty has problems and Lapisto can't give you minutes, well, then you've got big issues. But outside of that, I think that if things go moderately well in that area, I think the changes are irrelevant. What needs to happen is Marian Hossa's got to give you 35. He's got to be healthy, and he's got to give you 35 goals. You want Marian Hossa to be a point-of-game player. You know, you need Dave Bowen to be, you know, reasonably healthy. He's going to miss some time at some point. He plays a style of game, but you can't have Dave Bowen disappearing for 15 games at a time, whether he's on the ice or not. And Patrick Kane, Jonathan Toews, Patrick Sharp, and then an improved Keith, and a consistent Seabrook from game 1 to 82, if all of that takes place, I don't think there's a team in the West outside of L.A. that can touch them. And that has nothing to do with Carcillo Myers or Marcus Kruger. It's the Hawks' best players showing up this year and outperforming everybody else because they are that capable. And I think that'll be the story of the season. I look for it to happen. And, you know, what are your thoughts?
I agree. I think, you know, a lot of the changes, they're obviously an upgrade, and they could sign more than just the minimum wage type player. Where, you know, last year they were kind of scrapping at Fernando Pisani and Ryan Johnson and all the, you know, if this was last year, Brandon Segal would be, you know, he'd be talked about as like a third, fourth line player for this team if they were in the same situation. You know, it's nice that they can pick up an Andrew Burnett. So I think they're obviously much better than the team that opened up the season last year. As far as how much better they are than the team that ended the season, I think they're still a little bit better. You know, they're coming in a lot more refreshed, and I think that's going to make a huge difference. The big story that we won't be able to know about until March is, you know, what additions do they make? Because obviously this team isn't a finished product, and if, you know, anybody that's followed Stan Bowman the last 2 years knows that he wants to upgrade his team at the deadline as best he can, and he's going to leave room to do that. So I think, you know, as far as when you know, I know you mentioned earlier about the fourth line center, you know, Jamal Mayers is, you know, I think we both know that he's not that guy. And I think at some point, you know, that will be addressed, whether they pick somebody up off the scrap heap like they did with Ryan Johnson last year, or whether they make a trade for somebody at, you know, as the deadline approaches. I think, you know, they're gonna upgrade. So the team that's opening the season is, to me, is significantly better than the Hawk team that opened up last year. Whether or not they're going to be as, you know, as good, if they can take the eventual, you know, Western Conference champion to a seventh game, you know, I think that remains to be seen, because we don't really know what team is going to end the season.
I think, to get back to your point on the fourth line, I do think, especially if Marcus Kruger ends up as the center on that line, and maybe even to an extent if it happens to be Ben Smith, is I think what you're going to see is Myers is going to take a lot of draws, because he's actually a decent faceoff man, and he's got experience doing that. I think he'll take a lot of draws until Marcus Kruger proves that he can win them on his own, and, you know, they'll just shift, you know, after the puck drop. But you're right. I mean, you can't – Myers cannot cover that much ice to play center, but the way the Blackhawks center and – how much ice he's responsible for in that system, it can't be Myers. You're just asking for trouble.
No, not for 82 games.
Yeah. Jonathan Toews, and I want to kind of piggyback on a conversation that Al and I had last week, because I got emails on it. You know, a lot of people have just basically thrown Andrew Burnett on that line with, you know, the expectation that it'll be Toews and Kane. And I think that you and I would agree, and most people that have watched and saw the success that Toews and Hossa had together, that's the right combination. You know, you got Hossa and Toews, and then Sharp and Patrick Kane. Because number one, any line that Patrick Kane skates on, he's the puck distributor, and that takes some of that pressure off Patrick Sharp, and it puts him, even if he's at center ice, in more of a scorer's position. As long as you can find the right guy, you know, in a perfect world, if he's gone, but just to use an example, like an Andrew Ladd type of player who's that defensively aware and intelligent to play on that left side, you know, or if you could find a center to play between those two, that would be perfect as well. But I think we would agree, would we not, that that's the right, you know, the right mix at the top two. But Andrew Burnett has been thrown on that top line, and my concern about that is more about if you have Kane and Burnett on the line together with Jonathan Toews, it puts nearly all of the physical burden of that line on Toews' shoulders. And I don't know, given the way that he plays and the motor that he churns on a night-to-night basis, he does not have another, you know, he doesn't, you know, shift down. There's no shift down gear for Jonathan Toews. It's not in his DNA. That's what makes him so great. But if he's the guy that's got to be digging pucks along the wall and being the first guy in on a dump all the time, which he's not going to be because, like I mentioned before about a center, he's going to be caught deep a lot in a defensive zone. But if he's that guy, like he's the one, you know, trying to win all the battles for puck possession along the wall, I don't know that's, you know, that's not conducive to long-term success and keeping him healthy and having him, you know, have a good playoff potentially. Who's the right guy, in your mind, going into the season of what they have? Who's the right guy to play on that top line if it is Taves and Kane?
First off, I agree with you as far as I think we'll see them be split up a little bit more often this year. When you talk about, you know, having Taves and Hossa together and Sharp and Kane together and, you know, whoever else plays with them, you know, that'll just be the way it falls. Should they want Kane and Taves to skate together, which at least to start the season, I don't think we'll see. Obviously, you know, Joel Klenville's going to mix it up, you know, by the fifth game, and things will start, you know, shifting around. But if they do bring Kane and Taves together, you know, Brunette obviously has been the guy mentioned. I think Stahlberg's another guy that, you know, they played with him last year, and he'll be a guy who'll get a look just because there's, you know, they're going to be constantly looking for a spot to be. I'll make the comparison now that he's going to be the new Troy Brower, where they're going to just bounce him around everywhere, you know, minus the checking line. They'll put him on the first line, the second line, or the fourth line, and just kind of hope that he can get into like a 10-15 game groove. So I think Stahlberg will probably be, you know, choice number one. You know, depending on what's going on with Marcus Kruger and how well he's playing, you know, they'll probably, you know, give Patrick Sharp another, you know, another go around with him. You know, obviously they did it last year, but and I know you probably feel the same way. It just makes the Hawks way too top heavy, and it just, you know, completely saps their strength, which is their depth now. And I just don't see that happening for as long as it did last year. You know, they may give him a 5-game stretch, but it's not going to be, you know, the 30 games that they played together. So, like you said, I don't think that Brunette is going to be the guy that will play on their wing for, you know, 60, 70 games.
Yeah, I don't think, like I mentioned before, I don't think he can keep that pace, you know, with those guys that the Hawks are going to try to set. He's, you know, he's older. You know, I should say this, because I think it was misconstrued what I said last week about Brunette, is, you know, he uses his ass. You know, he's a little bit like Phil Esposito was back in the day, where he goes to the front of the net. He's very intelligent about how he uses his body in front of the net, but he's not a guy that's just going to stand there and attract somebody, and he's going to stand to the side. He's going to wait until the play develops, and then he'll go to the front of the net. He's not necessarily I think what people think of as net front presence. He's not really that guy, but he's also very intelligent about going in behind, you know, when the puck is dumped in. And let's just say Jonathan Taves is the first guy in. He's on that end wall. He's in the corner, wherever he's at, fighting for the puck. Brunette, like Patrick Kane, but I think Patrick Kane's one of the best in the world at this, is coming in as that second guy in and just taking his stick and just lifting that puck out of there and winning that puck battle on the wall. And just skating out with it and, you know, redistributing the puck, sending it back to the point, setting up the play. He's very good at that, too. But, again, he's very rarely going to be the first guy to the puck. Depending, you know, if he's standing at the blue line and the thing gets dumped in, then yeah. But if it's the typical red line dump in, Brunette's not going to get there first. So that's why, you know, you make a good point. Stahlberg would be a guy who could get to the puck. It's just a question of whether or not Stahlberg is going to win those man-on-man battles with any sort of consistency. Because if he's not, then Quenville's going to take him right off that line. And, you know, that combination won't last. So, you know, yeah, it's the puck possession battle, you know, the man-on-man battles along the wall that I think – if that Brunette, Kane, and Taves thing, that's my concern, is that too much of that physical exertion is going to fall on Taves' shoulders, because it's, you know Kane's not going to be doing that, because that's not his, you know, he's not going to be getting knocked out around down there. His strength is to come in and lift that puck while somebody else, you know, ties up somebody else's stick, you know. So we'll see how it works out, but I don't see that threesome working out over the long haul. They'll have stretches. Like you said, when the Hawks lose, Joel Quenville changes the lines. That's his reaction. Almost every single loss. So they'll play together. They'll have success. And people will say, oh, you know, Block, you were wrong. And that's fine. But I think over the long haul, I don't see how that mix works for them. Moving along, a couple more things before we wrap up. The Ray Emery coming into camp on the tryout for the backup job with Alexander Salak. Have any thoughts on how that's going to shake out? I mean, you're like you got to claim you haven't seen Salak aside from maybe some highlights, and anybody can look great on highlights. So, any thoughts on how that's going to shake out?
I'll be stunned if Ray Emery's not the Blackhawks' backup goalie. I think with how weak the Hawks are in their system at goaltender, and especially in Rockford, I think Salak being on a I'm pretty sure he's on a one-way deal to where he's going to make $600,000 wherever he's playing.
Yeah.
I can't see Ray Emery not being the backup. I think it's just going to be too good of a story to pass up, and it's almost the perfect situation for him to where he'll be able to play 30-some games, and, he's not going to have his, growth stunt or anything like that, whereas, if Alexander Salak was – the backup, you could have definite worries about him not getting seen enough action.
Yeah, and you talked about Carcillo. I mean, you talk about a guy who's got something to prove. I mean, he came back, I think, admittedly too early, and because of the vertigo with Jonas Hiller, I mean, he was thrust into a position where, I mean, he was just expecting to be the backup and play here and there and sit on the bench in the playoffs, and all of a sudden, I mean, the job was his, and he played a lot more than he was expecting to, and he played very well. He started giving up garbage goals. I think that a lot of that was due to fatigue once he got into the playoffs. But, I mean, this is a guy who's appears to be determined and ready to come in. He said, we'll see, but he said it's NHL contract or bust for him. So he's got a lot to play for, too. I agree with you. I think he's going to be the guy. Salak will go down and play with probably Alec Richards, but we'll see. But I do think that's the way it's going to shake out. I'd be shocked, but I guess it all depends on what games he gets in the preseason. That's the other interesting thing, is if he's only getting road games where the Blackhawks are only sending three or four of their better players, if they're sending any at all, then he's going to have a tough time playing well and winning that job. So that's something to look for, too. Don't underestimate that. Where he plays, who he plays behind, because, I don't think that, like you said, it's too good of a story. I don't think they're going to stack the deck up against him, because if you would, why would you bring him in? I think that the job is his for him to win, and I would expect him to win it. Because of that, it's not like it's his last stand. He can get another job. If Ray Emery, of all people, can come back after the problems that he's had and the problems that he's caused in locker rooms, he'll probably get another job, because it appears as though he's turned a corner professionally dealing with media and his teammates. But this is a big one for him, and I expect him to win that job. I don't know how much you've been paying attention to the rest of the league, but any team, and let's just talk about the West, anybody stand out to you? As far as who's going to be the main competitor for the Blackhawks this season?
Well, obviously you mentioned L.A. earlier, and I know you're doing the podcast tomorrow with that blog, and obviously they're scary. But right now with no Drew Doughty, it's just an interesting contract squabble that they're having out west with between him and Dean Lombardi. And obviously the Sharks, with Martin Havlat now, people kind of forget, how much significantly better they're going to be. The key question will be is last year in the Western Conference Finals, I felt for the second year in a row, Todd McClellan panicked. And he tried to do something with Ben Eager that just wasn't going to work. Then he got mad at Ben Eager for doing exactly what Ben Eager is going to do. And then, he just stopped playing his fourth line in general. And Vancouver just chewed him up and spit him out because they were rolling four lines. By the third period, Joe Thornton and Patrick Marleau were on, they were on oxygen. They could barely breathe. So I think San Jose, if Martin Havlat and Todd McClellan, give them the type of seasons that they should, the Sharks and the Kings are going to have one hell of a battle out in that division. But, a lot of that depends on, Drew Doughty signing in time. And Martin Havlat staying healthy, and Todd McClellan progressing as a coach.
You're right, because, you know, with, on the Doughty front, you know, the Sharks are an interesting bunch with all the changes that they made. But I think that it's been understated, maybe locally here in Chicago, just from what I hear people saying. But it's understated that now they have, on separate pairings, they're going to throw out Dan Boyle and Brent Burns. And the way that they're going to be able to move that puck from their blue line, sort of like how the Blackhawks have been in recent years, I think they're dangerous. And but I mean, we'll see. I mean, they've got a lot of like the Hawks. They've got a lot of growing together to do. But on the LA front, you're absolutely right. If they don't have Doughty to start the season, and they've got to, you know, mix with their new group, and they get off to a slow start, it doesn't matter how much talent you have. If you're swimming against the current from game 15 or 20 on, it's going to be a rough season. And so it's important for them to get him under contract and start strong and let their skill take over, because they've got a very balanced team with him. And, I mean, they've got it all to win the conference, but they've never done it before, which is big. You know, they've never done that. So we'll see. But they've certainly got a lot of talent now, and they're going to be dangerous. And the Red Wings, too, you know. The Red Wings, you know, don't count them out. They never seem to be healthy from the beginning to end, which has been their problem. But Nicklas Lidström, you know, he still had a very, very good year last year. And I don't see – the only thing there is – I mean, Rafalski didn't have a great year last year, but they're replacing him with Ian White. And I've never been an Ian White supporter. But, you know, he's going to be thrust in that position. I think they're going to put him with Lidström and Cronwall and Erickson, and then you got Brendan Smith coming up. I think they expect Brendan Smith to come up, the old Wisconsin kid. Old, I mean, he left Wisconsin early, but he spent a year in Grand Rapids last year, had injury problems, but with a knee. But, I mean, they expect him to come up, and then you've got Brad Stewart. I think I mentioned Jonathan Erickson. So they've got a great defense as well. So we shall see. Quick question before we go. Shea Weber, does he finish the year in Nashville?
Yes, but doesn't start their year next year. He'll be gone, I think. I think they'll keep him through the playoffs, and then after that, he'll be gone.
Yeah, any early thoughts on where he would go? I know that Toronto is the team that always gets mentioned.
Yeah, Toronto obviously is the, you know, it's usually a surprise team that kind of comes in out of nowhere. I mean, nobody thought that the Kings were going to be in on Mike Richards, and that's where he ended up. So I think all the big-name teams that usually get mentioned, you know, Toronto, Detroit, he'll probably end up in the exact opposite situation as either of those two teams.
Yeah, so thanks again for coming on the show again, John, and good luck with the site this year and whatever you're whatever you decide to do, we'll be reading. It's, of course, fifthfeather.com, and look for fifthfeather.com to get going here in the coming weeks. John, thanks so much for joining us. Again, next week, Monday, I believe we're going to record in the afternoon. Mike Peck, Monday, September 12th, and then sometime after that, Sam Fells, committed to Indian SecondCityHockey.com, and then we got a lot of other stuff going on that I don't have locked down, so I can't say. But thanks again, John. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll talk to you next week. Good night, everybody.